So, as Rivermaster said, we're going to be doing a lay ordination, and it seemed like it was useful to talk about the ceremonies for Jukai, because each of the Jukai has five major ceremonies, and each one of those ceremonies embodies an idea that we make use of in training with and practicing keeping the precepts. And so it seemed like a good idea to talk about the idea behind the ceremony. I won't talk about what the ceremony is like all that much, just in case you might actually get to go to Jukai, and it's useful to just kind of go through it with a kind of open mind. But I do want to talk about the ideas that are behind the ceremonies, because they're really incorporated in the training of the precepts. First, when you go to Jukai at Shasta, and traditionally in Japan, you would spend a week at the monastery, and each day for 5 of those 7 days, you would have a major ceremony, and everything stops in the temple. You know, you're sort of going about the regular temple life, and then the ceremony, it's time for the ceremony, and everything stops. Everybody comes to the ceremony. It's a fairly big deal. And so in the context of that week, the week is actually what we call a session, or a searching of the heart and cleansing of karma retreat. So session is a traditional Japanese term. It literally means search the heart. Shin is the character that we use for the heart-mind in Buddhism. And it symbolizes a sort of combination between our mind and heart, deeper than both of those things, but sort of where Buddha nature lives. So session is searching of the heart retreat. So in the context of Jukai, you're doing this retreat. You're searching your heart. You're looking deeply within yourself to see what is good to do, how to go forward, what are the issues in your life that you're kind of dealing with and want to train with. That process of looking within and self-examination is part and parcel of what we're talking about when we talk about cleansing karma. Cleansing karma, if you remember the idea that we teach in Soto Zen, which is that all beings have Buddha nature by, it's just an inherent characteristic of their life, of their being. All beings are Buddha nature as characteristic, and all beings in a sense are enlightened from the beginning. So that's the sort of natural state of a being. The problem being, we don't necessarily know that. We don't see that. And the reason we don't see that is because there are veils of ignorance, veils of misunderstanding covering up our inherent Buddha nature, our inherent enlightenment. Those veils, those clouds, those misunderstandings that we have in our minds are what we refer to as karma. And the practice of meditation, the practice of following the precepts, the path of Buddhism is the path of coming to understand what those misunderstandings, those delusions, those veils are, and beginning to shed them, to relinquish them, so that we can see our own selves more clearly and life more clearly. So the process of training the path, process of walking the path of Buddhism is a process that we is strongly identified with cleansing karma. It's not the only thing that we do on the path, but that's a really important part of it. And cleansing karma is part and parcel, again, of what we're doing when we're keeping the precepts and when we're practicing the precepts. So when we notice, say, we're going along through our daily life, we have the impulse to steal candy from the local store, and you notice that, and you realize, oh, that's a habit I've gotten myself into. What is that the process of that would be to say, oh, that's non-perceptual. That's taking something that's not freely given. So I need to look at that. I look at that and think, oh, okay, I can physically keep myself from doing that. I'll put my hands in my pockets when I go past the candy aisle in the store. But then looking deeper, there's this impulse to take that candy. What is that impulse? What is that thing that makes me want to take that inappropriate thing? What is that? So then I apply meditation to that impulse. I sit still within it as it comes up and look carefully at it. Look carefully at what that impulse means. And eventually we come to understand it on a deeper level, and we're able to actually just let go of that impulse as well. And so that impulse goes away. That's what we're talking about in terms of cleansing karma. Usually it's connected to a deeper pattern, and so that might lead us into another area of ourselves where we feel, you know, the deeper pattern might be we have a deep sense of feeling like we're not complete, and having that candy, taking that thing, might contribute a little bit to that feeling of incompleteness. But again, as we go along on the path, we're looking more deeply into how our minds work and what is going on, and so then we sit with that impulse of feeling incomplete and look more deeply into that. It goes on and on. So the process of cleansing karma is also part of the precepts, keeping the precepts. And back to our theme of the retreat of Jukai, that's the context in which we go and which we're doing these ceremonies, looking at our hearts, looking at what's going on in our hearts and minds. There are other sessions during the year at a big monastery. There are other retreats during the year, and they have all slightly different focuses. Sometimes, like at Shasta, they just have meditation retreats, and you just go and do meditation. And there's no particular theme or topic or anything like that. You just sit there. And that's still the process of looking within, searching the heart, learning more deeply about ourselves. The retreat of Jukai, as it's kind of formally called, is the opening of the gate, the ceremonies for the opening of the gate of the 10 precepts. That's what the Jukai is kind of formally translated as. And so it's useful to think about taking the precepts as going through a gate. And it is a gate that is really open to whomever wishes to do so, whomever wishes to keep it. And it is a gate that we encounter along the path that we're walking on. We start along the path, you know, with the impulse, well, there must be something a little deeper about life. There must be some other way of understanding things. There must be a better way to live than I'm living now. And I'm going to go in search of that thing. And that is the kind of first step along our path. And so then as we go along, we might go to, our path might lead us to the spiritual supermarket, where there are different kind of ways of going about a spiritual life. You have the inclination, oh, I feel like there's something I want to look at spiritually or want to have a spiritual dimension in my life. So you go to the supermarket and you look around for the different paths, and something resonates with you. And so then you kind of begin to study that thing and follow it along. And eventually you want to consider going through the gate of the commitment to that path. And that, in a sense, is what taking the precepts is. It's kind of like saying, okay, this really seems to work for me, and I'm going to commit myself to this particular path. I'm going to commit myself to these particular precepts. And as we say, we're not so much making, I mean, in one sense, you know, we do have our way of articulating the precepts, but what we're trying to do with the offering of ordination is give people the opportunity to commit themselves to Buddhism, to the Buddha Dharma, and to the Buddha's way of understanding things. So not necessarily our tradition, our practice. When I was first going to the temple in Portland many years ago, you know, it was Reverend Master Jiu was was thinking along the lines of putting out a practice, you know, putting forth a practice where Buddhists of all denominations could come and join in. People of different perspectives could come and join in. She was saying, you know, you might be the only Buddhist in the neighborhood. So in the back of the lay liturgy, there's some Theravadan scriptures. There's some Tibetan scriptures, things that people from different traditions might feel familiar with if they came to practice in a Zen temple. There's the lotus ceremony, which is really a multi-denominational ceremony, which we, I don't know if we've done here before, but and it was designed in a sense, according to my understanding of what River Master Jiyu was trying to do, it was designed in a sense to just be a ceremony for Buddhists. And so in that sense, the commitment that of taking the precepts is the commitment to the Buddha Dharma, the way of the Buddha, the path of the Buddha. And as I say, you know, there is, you know, we do have our particular way of articulating it, so we're going to do it in our form. So, Jukai, opening the gate of the precepts, and when we go through that gate, we're learning then again to refine our understanding of what the path is, to say this is more to have a clearer understanding of what we're doing in practice, how we're going forward in along this path. Interestingly, it is interesting in that, okay, there's an idea of a mandala in Buddhism, where Master Koten is real kind of into mandalas, so he's given a number of lectures on this subject. And you encounter this in Buddhist iconography pretty much all over the Buddhist world. And an idea of a mandala is sort of a circular path. You kind of enter a mandala, go around an outer circle, take another step in, go around an inner circle, take another step in, go around an inner circle, take another step in, and you're at the center. And in a sense, our path is walking along this mandala. Well, one of the characteristics of a mandala is that there are frequently kind of gatekeepers at the mandala. You know, kind of, there's a quality of fierceness of going into the path, going deeply into the path, going deeply into our minds, in a way. And so frequently, for instance, I've noticed for myself when I go to a retreat, I'll have this kind of nervous quality arising, like, oh my God, what am I doing here? What have I gotten myself into? And I think of that as kind of like that gatekeeper, where somebody's saying, in effect, they're saying, this is something that is potent and significant. This is something that that will change you. This is something that is real and will change you. And that can arise as a nervousness or a fearfulness or that sort of thing. I remember, I've talked to a number of people who say going to a retreat at Shasta Abbey brings forth this kind of anxiety sometimes for them. It'll bring forth kind of worries and fears. And in a sense, coming to the temple, I'm sure also has a mild quality of that. Like, we have to, there's a kind of like a speed bump that we have to get over in order to come to the temple. You know, we're kind of thinking about it and think, no, I really want to do that. And you have to kind of grasp your will a little bit and say, I'm going to go. And so frequently, Jukai, in a way, is kind of like one of those big steps into the mandala. And it can produce its own kind of anxiety, its own kind of worry. What am I getting myself into? And that's not such a bad thing, because we really do want to look at what we're getting ourselves into. On the other hand, we might actually want to get ourselves into that thing, if you know what I mean. So And this is not something that ever really goes away. It was interesting that there was a Theravadin monk who came to Shasta Abbey, who was a monk for, I think he was a monk for 65, 68 years when he showed up at the abbey. His name was the Venerable Dr. Ratnasara. He was one of the most senior Theravadin bhikkhus in Sri Lanka. And he was teaching and active in the West, very instrumental in establishing a lot of educational institutions in Sri Lanka, really a very dynamic kind of monk. And he was telling us, as he spent 4 or 5 days with us at Shasta, and he was telling us that he said, as I was coming up the hill, I had the feeling of approaching a training monastery. And to me, I'm thinking, God, even after 68 years, you have that kind of feeling like, ooh, what am I getting myself into? And he was really quite an amazing, quite a wonderful person. So this is just part of how we live, part of what goes on in the mind. That little bit of anxiety, and maybe it's the self, maybe it's the self kind of saying, wait a minute, I don't want to give up control of myself. There it is. So at the gate, we might encounter some quality of fierceness. There are five ceremonies during the week that we'll be talking about. And then often, or at least at Shasta, they will also do the renewal of vows. And it is, I know of some lay practitioners who, one particular lay practitioner, a man who I quite respect, who would go to Shasta every year. He'd been practicing probably longer than I have. For a long, long time, he would go to Shasta every year for Jukai, just to kind of renew his commitment. And in the monastic community at Shasta, they do the renewal of vows ceremonies every 2 weeks, and that's traditional in monastic practice to renew our vows to practice every 2 weeks. And that ceremony is both renewing our commitment to the precepts, but it's also renewing our commitment to the bodhisattva vows and to our kind of form of practice in a way. And so that ceremony is also done at Jukai. The five ceremonies of Jukai begin with a ceremony called the reading of the precepts. I don't know what its Japanese name is. Ceremony of the Reading of the Ten Precepts. So this happens on the first or second full day of the first full day of the retreat, and it is quite simply the reading out loud of the precepts, and the celebrant asks, "Will you keep these precepts or not?" There's a reading of the precepts, then the precentor says, "Great priest, I pray that you may administer the precepts to these worthy persons who wish to practice the Buddha's way during this week and become the Buddha's sons and daughters." And then the celebrant says, "Will you keep these precepts or not?" And the congregants say, "I will." Now, there's a couple of things going on in this ceremony that are pretty important. It seems quite simple. And it is. First, when we go to a temple, we are tacitly agreeing to keep the precepts while we are there. We more or less overtly ask people, when you come to the temple, please keep the precepts while you're here. And that is part of the training of being at the temple. And so during the week of Jukai, what we're doing is saying, okay, we're going to keep the precepts during this week best we can. And part of that means, part of that is also being a vegetarian during that time. Because we, you know, for monastics at least, we view that as part of keeping the precepts. And so right off the bat, that's what we're doing. We're kind of saying, this is part of the practice. Keeping the precepts is part of the practice. Now, there's an important quality of that ceremony, reading the precepts, where the celebrant, who's usually the abbot of the temple or another kind of weighty monastic, is giving voice to the precepts, is actually saying it. It's not just our intuition of morality, which we all possess. It's a real human being who's giving expression to the precepts. And that quality of encountering someone who is practicing the precepts and can articulate them is really a quite important part of the practice. Is really quite an important part of how we train in a sense, and how we give and receive the precepts. And so what it's in a sense telling us is the practice of the precepts are for human beings. The practice of the precepts arise within a human life and encompass a human life. And so they are for us, they are for human beings, and they are practicable by human beings. And when we hear a real human being giving expression to that, it, I think, makes a deep impression. It kind of says, oh, okay, this is not just an idea from on high that's come down to us. This is the life of human beings and can affect us and influence our lives for the positive, I think, but is a real part of, can be a real part of life. So then, just the human being saying it, and we get to hear, sometimes there might be a little lecture, sometimes not. In my experience, it's mostly been not so much of a lecture, just simply the precepts. And so we can kind of clearly understand, oh, okay, here's the contract, in a sense. Here's what's going to be asked of me, and now I can clearly say this is the realm in which we're training. So I think that's pretty much what I wanted to say about that ceremony. Do you have anything
more to add? Just one particular phrase that you use kind of resonated with me, which I wanted to mention in this context. We're talking about grasping the will. That's what it takes to just come for an orientation. That's what it takes to come for a retreat. It's what it takes to come whenever you come. It's what it takes to decide, I'm going to commit myself to this. And it's what it takes to get up in the morning and meditate. It's what it takes to decide, you know, I want that candy, but I'm not going to take it. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about grasping the will. That's really one of the most fundamental aspects of training. And there are two aspects of grasping the will. There is a determination. There's a strength in this. I'm going to change something that I have been doing, and I'm going to do something different now that maybe feels uncomfortable because it's unfamiliar. I'm going to deliberately try my best to do something about myself, about something that needs to be changed on whatever level. It may be a small thing in the broader range of things, or it may be a larger thing in the broader range of things. It's not important. It's something, it's a process that we learn, that we keep using throughout our training. We keep applying it to various aspects of our training throughout our daily life. And another aspect of that grasping the will is that willingness, which is so important. there's a softer aspect. That the grasping the will can sound like this kind of macho, I'm going to get out there and I'm going to, you know, stop smoking today, whatever it is. And the willingness comes in with, okay, if I smoked again, I'm going to be willing to forgive myself, and I'm going to grasp the will again and determine not to do it tomorrow. And if we make another mistake, and we will. You know, part of something I have discovered in my own training is it takes repeatedly bumping into something for me to even see that I need to do something about it. Something that can be obvious to other people, but for some reason is not obvious to me. And then once I finally decide I want to do something about it, it can take repeatedly bringing that up in my mind, in a sense, trying to grasp my will to actually figure out how to do something about that. And this is, in a sense, a retreat in miniature. Each time this arises, this is grasping the will. And then, once we have, in a sense, grasped the idea to really do something about it, I find I still continually fall back. I still continually let myself be controlled by the old habits. It can take a long time, sometimes hours, sometimes days, sometimes years, for me to actually change something the first time. And it just seems, you know, I've got to be careful in this process not to judge myself, just to keep working at it. So that's why I'm talking, the willingness is so important an aspect here. And it needs to be not only grasping the will, I'm going to take the precepts, but there also needs to be a willingness to take the precepts, because that lets the compassion in, that lets the willingness to see the self as it really is into this whole process. And then once we actually do change some aspect of ourselves that needs changing, I find that I manage it once and then repeatedly don't. I repeatedly fall back into the old habits. And then somehow or other, I manage it again. And then I repeatedly fall back into the old habits. So this seems to be, at least for me, a part of this process and a part of our looking at ourselves, a part of our seeing what needs to be done in our own training. And so we may, you know, repeatedly decide, well, I need to get to the Priory, or I need to get to Shasta, or I want to go to Jukai. And for days or weeks or even years, whatever, we don't make it. And then somehow it keeps coming up and we manage it. And that's the first, well, it's not the first step. That is a step in the process. So we want to do our best to recognize that it is important to grasp the will. We want to cultivate our effort in grasping the will, and we also want to cultivate willingness to help ourselves to keep going. And we keep working on that willingness, and as I was saying earlier, sometimes that's really hard to do. So fine, let's just be willing to be willing. And there have been many times when I haven't been able to manage that. I had to fall back on being willing to be willing to be willing to be willing. Somewhere in there, I could find some way to take the next step. And that's what a retreat is. That's what Jukai is. That's what getting up in the morning and I'm going to do my best to train today is. That grasping the will, that willingness. And it takes that continuously working on doing that. And what Jukai can be is it can simply be a larger I can't think of the word I'm using symbol on the road. It can be a landmark. You know, I'm going to get to that point to help us, because sometimes it can be difficult for us to see that anything's going on in our training. And it can be difficult, especially if we're the depression type, to keep going when there is no obvious, you know, I'm doing this, I'm trying to do it, and it's not changing anything. Well, actually it is. We need to be willing to trust the training, and it can be compassionate to do something like formally taking the precepts or formally going to Jikai or just getting to the prior.
There's a kind of quality of willingness I think of that I think of as being sort of a gentle persistence to keep going, to keep at it, to just keep being. And to me, it's keep being true to the wish of my own heart, the wish of my own kind of impulse to do good and to not harm beings. In practice, the Chinese say that in the beginning, the Buddha is right in front of us. And then after a year or two, he's off in space. And then after 6 or 7 years, he's gone off to the Western paradise. So our enthusiasm arises from this kind of clear thinking, oh wow, this is really great. And we just, if we can begin in that time of enthusiasm and to cultivate as we go along, that just gentle persistence and that recognition, this is coming from me. Practice is coming from the wish of my own heart. And it's something I want to be true to myself with. Then we can kind of develop the strength to keep going as things get more difficult. I don't know what it looks like after 35 years or 40 years, but maybe Professor Rokuzawa can tell you. But you know, from my perspective, I'm just kind of thinking, well, I don't know, anyway. I'm just going to think, well, how could I do anything else but practice? Just kind of ingrained in it.
As Reverend Master Daizri used to say, it's interesting when you ask monks about that, you'll often get the answer, I don't have anything better. Which is kind of, well, wait a minute, that's not exactly the answer I thought I was going to get, and yet it really goes to the heart of the matter. I don't have anything better to do. And that's what I find. And you know, the Buddha's right there, and not. It's just whatever you need. It's just comes back to being open, being willing to look up. And that actually helps me remember something else I wanted to say. Some of the fear potentially in all of this process can be, at least for me, it was kind of convoluted. It was a sense of, If I go to Jikai, if I take the precepts, if I start to train, if I open myself up to this, I'm going to see, I'm going to be judged. I'm going to see a bad person there. I'm going to see all my mistakes. Other people are going to judge me badly, something like that. And for me, that was part of the fear in this whole process. And it's important to recognize that the precepts are not rules. The precepts aren't sins we measure our badness by. The precepts are meant to help us. They're a remarkably compassionate thing for us to do, because on a very real, basic sense, they make our life more pleasant in many ways. That's not to say that we don't recognize past mistakes and continue to have the consequences for that. That's not to say that we that we don't recognize that we have lots of things that we need to change. And with taking the precepts for me, my recognition of those things is no longer painful. It's simply, that's what needs to be done. It's simply, I don't have anything better to work on. It's simply, this is a being over which I have some control that needs help. And by taking the precepts, I can help that being. And ultimately, it's a remarkably compassionate thing to do. It's training for self and others. But we start right here with number one, and that's okay. And that helps me in my willingness to take the precepts, my willingness to grasp the will, that this is really a benefit for all beings of which I am one, and of which I am the first to benefit from my own keeping of the precepts. So maybe that can be helpful if anyone else here experiences that same fear of being judged or of looking at their mistakes, seeing the difficulty involved. If we are willing to let go of our fear of the difficulty and willing to look at the benefit from this activity, maybe that will help us to grasp our will. Maybe that will help us to willingly enter this path and to follow it.
So are there any questions or thoughts?
You mentioned something about with the precepts at Jukai, that there was a discussion or maybe a lecture or a festival about the 10 precepts, but also the path of the bodhisattvas, or something similar to that?
Well, what I was talking about was in the renewal of vows ceremony,
okay,
which is the ceremony that the monks do and lay people participate in, which renews the vows every fortnight, every 2 weeks. And in that ceremony, we are also renewing our commitment to the bodhisattva practices, the bodhisattva vows. You know, however innumerable beings may be, I vow to save them all. However inexhaustible the passions may be, I vow to transform them all. However limitless the Dharma may be, I vow to comprehend it completely. However infinite the Buddha's truth is, I vow to realize it. Those are the bodhisattva vows, and they are implicit in the precepts that we're taking. The precepts that we take in our tradition are called the bodhisattva precepts, and they are implicit in that. In the renewal of vows ceremony, we actually make it explicit. We all kind of together say, recite those vows. And we, in a sense, give homage to and express our commitment to the various Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as well. And so we are, in that respect, sort of committing ourselves to our Mahayana kind of tradition and practice in that ceremony. And maybe as part of this, we'll talk about that ceremony more specifically.
Aren't the Bodhisattva vows usually only taken by monks?
No. There are various ceremonies for taking the Bodhisattva vows in Mahayana Buddhism, and many lay people in China and Japan take the Bodhisattva vows as well. And in a sense, lay practice is a really excellent place to take the Bodhisattva vows and to put them into practice, because, you know, there's the deeply spiritual aspect of it, but there's also just the aspect of, you know, part of practice is converting my, there's a line in the Lotus Ceremony I was talking about earlier, all our covert earthly toils are converted to Buddhist service. In a sense, you know, one of the opportunities of practice is to make all of our actions in the world expressive of the Dharma, expressive of Buddhism. And so it means just taking our regular kind of action in the world and making it into bodhisattva service, whatever it is, whether we're street cleaner, a neurosurgeon, you know, corporate businessman in corporate America, whatever, teacher, lawyer, whatever we do, nurse, whatever. We in a sense, through practice, make that into bodhisattva service. And so to me, the bodhisattva vows and lay practice are deeply, potentially deeply harmonious. Yes?
I was wondering if you would just read us the precepts, because I don't have them memorized.
Ah.
Please, be my guest.
Okay.
The great precepts of the Buddhas are kept carefully by the Buddhas. Buddhas give them to Buddhas. Ancestors give them to ancestors. The transmission of the precepts is beyond the three existences of past, present, and future. Enlightenment ranges from time eternal and is even now. Shakyamuni Buddha, our Lord, transmitted the precepts to Makakasho, and he transmitted them to Ananda. Thus the precepts have been transmitted to me in the 86th generation. I am now giving them to you in order to show my gratitude for the compassion of the Buddhas and thus make them the eyes of all sentient beings. This is the meaning of the transmission of the living wisdom of the Buddhas. I am going to pray for the Buddha's guidance, and you should make confession and be given the precepts. Please recite this verse after me. All wrong actions, behavior, and karma perpetrated by me from time immemorial have been and are caused by greed, anger, and delusion, which have no beginning, born of my body, mouth, and will. I now make full and open confession thereof. Now, by the guidance of the Buddhas and ancestors, we can discard and purify all our karma of body, mouth, and will, and obtain great immaculacy. This is by the power of confession. You should now be converted to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. In the three treasures, there are three merits. The first is the true source of the three treasures. The second is the presence in the past of the Buddha. The third is his presence at the present time. The highest truth is called the Buddha treasure. Immaculacy is called the Dharma treasure. Harmony is called the Sangha treasure. The person who has realized the truth really is called the Buddha treasure. The truth that is realized by Buddha is called the Dharma treasure. The people who study the Dharma treasure are called the Sangha treasure. He who teaches devas and humans, appearing in the sky and in the world, is called the Buddha treasure. That which appears in the world, in the scriptures, and becomes good for others, is called the Dharma treasure. He who is released from all suffering and is beyond the world is called the Sangha treasure. This means that when someone is converted to the three treasures, he can have the precepts of the Buddhas completely. Make the Buddha your teacher and do not follow wrong ways. The three pure precepts. Cease from evil. This is the house of all the laws of Buddha. This is the source of all the laws of Buddha. Do only good. The Dharma of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment is the Dharma of all existence. Do good for others. Be beyond both the holy and the unholy. Let us rescue ourselves and others. These three are called the three pure precepts. The 10 great precepts. Do not kill. No life can be cut off. The life of Buddha is increasing. Continue the life of Buddha. Do not kill Buddha. Do not steal. The mind and its object are one. The gateway to enlightenment stands open wide. Do not covet. The doer, the doing, and that which has the doing done to it are immaculate. Therefore, there is no desire. It is the same doing as that of the Buddhas. Do not say that which is not true. The wheel of the Dharma rolls constantly, lacks for nothing, and needs something. The sweet dew covers the whole world, and within it lies the truth. Do not sell the wine of delusion. There is nothing to be deluded about. If we realize this, we are enlightenment itself. Do not speak against others. In Buddhism, the truth and everything are the same. The same law, the same enlightenment, and the same behavior. Do not allow anyone to speak of another's faults. Do not allow anyone to make a mistake in Buddhism. Do not be proud of yourself and devalue others. Every Buddha and every ancestor realizes that he is the same as the limitless sky and as great as the universe. When they realize their true body, there is nothing within or without. When they realize their true body, they are nowhere upon the earth. Do not be mean in giving either dharma or wealth. There is nothing to be mean with. One phrase, one verse, 100 grasses, one dharma, one enlightenment, every Buddha, every ancestor. Do not be angry. There is no retiring, no going, no truth, no lie. There is a brilliant sea of clouds. There is a dignified sea of clouds. Do not defame the three treasures. To do something by ourselves without copying others is to become an example to the world, and the merit of doing such a thing becomes the source of all wisdom. Do not criticize. Accept everything. These 16 precepts are thus: be obedient to the teaching and its giving, accept it with bows.
So we'll continue over the next number of weeks to talk about these ceremonies. Probably next week we won't talk about it because we'll be having a festival and a potluck, and you know, there's just going to be too much going on. But we'll try to get back to it on the following Sunday. And we'll try to post them online so if people want, they can re-listen to them, or if they're not able to make it, they can listen to them online.